Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Les Novaresi, 93 years old and a nearly lifelong resident of Stockton, California. The youngest of three brothers born to immigrants from Switzerland, all three of them would go on to serve in our armed forces during World War II. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you can link to a thorough and outstanding article about the three Novaresi boys that was published in the Stockton Record a number of years ago. Les and his brother Elmo were both drafted out of Stockton's Edison High School. Elmo became a combat engineer, while Les ended up in the 7th Infantry Division and fought in the Battle of Okinawa. When we left off, he was telling us about an incident that happened right after the fighting ended there. Les and Elmo's older brother, Sid, had joined the National Guard after graduating Stockton High School in 1939 and was called to active duty after the attack on Pearl Harbor 2 years later. Sid Novaresi became a P-47 Thunderbolt pilot, flying 125 missions with the 413th Fighter Group. While Les and Elmo both served in World War II and the Korean War, the oldest Novaresi brother, Sid, would add Vietnam to his list of flying duties and would make the military a career, rising to the rank of Major General in 1977. Back in 1945, Sid was flying his P-47 on combat missions off of Aishima, an island that would become well known as the spot where journalist Ernie Pyle was killed on April 18th of that year. It wasn't too long after that that Sid found out somehow that his baby brother, 18-year-old Les, was on nearby Okinawa, and the brotherly reunion that followed came as quite a surprise to Les.
And he flew over my camp, and I don't really know how he found out I was there. They flew over in a formation of three and flew over and then went right up over top of us. And then he landed and talked to my commander, got me to go over and visit him at Aishima. So I went down to Naha, the field, and flew over in a C-47 and visited him, and they dressed me up as a first lieutenant and so I could mingle with the guys, and they had chow with them, and they showed me films of their deeds when they flew into Tokyo shooting their rockets and stuff and shooting at boats and things, and that was exciting. So then I went back to my unit, and then from there, of course, we were training to attack Japan. There was going to be 99% casualties, and then they dropped the bomb, thank God. And I remember one of my sergeants said, he says, you know, it's going to be tough. You're going to go in, and it's going to be 99% casualties, and they're going to come out with these spears and everything. He said, unfortunately, I won't be with you. Of course, he was joking. Mm-hmm. So then, of course, the war stopped, and we left Okinawa, and we went to Korea, occupied Korea, and I was about the 26th man ashore there. We circled in these Higgins boats to give us the lights from the shore to go in, and we landed, and the tide went in, went 36 feet, I think, and so we had to wait till the tide went in, and then we landed, and then we went in and went into the airfield, and camped out there at the airfield, and then we started going north and taking the Japanese, taking them in custody, and shipping them back out to the coast to send back to Japan. That's about it, you know. And then we occupied it, and I left there in 6 months and came back to the States.
Well, a couple of things come to mind. First of all, you're telling this story about Okinawa, and your brother flies over, and you're trying to figure out how he even knows you're there. But you said something. I want to make sure people understand it. So in order for you to actually mingle with your brother and his fellow pilots, they had to put you in disguise, because you're an enlisted man in the Army. You're what, a PFC?
PFC.
So you're a PFC, and they have to give you a lieutenant's uniform. Otherwise, you can't even be around your brother. Were you nervous that you'd be found out?
No, I was having a hell of a time. They were all drinking, and I didn't drink at the time. And they had a few nurses to come by and mingle with them. And they went out and showed me their airplanes, and he showed me his airplane, which I, in private, in civilian life, I trained as a as an aircraft mechanic. So that was interesting to me. But I had a ball with him. He was a hell of a brother.
Well, and you mentioned you guys actually had the opportunity to watch the film that had been taken from the cameras on the planes. Right. What was that like to watch that? Because that's not a movie. That's real life.
No, there's no sound to it. You watch it. One of the films, he was going in and shooting at a boat, and you could see the bullets going in, and then there was bullets coming back out. I said, what? He said, they're shooting back at me. So, and then there was another film that when he went into Tokyo, he was shooting rockets into a building. You could see the rockets going in. It was really, really something. Unfortunately, he lost all of his camera films. He set his kit bag down somewhere, and then he lost it. He misplaced it. I would have loved to have those a souvenir. Yeah.
Well, and something else, and I know some things can be hard to talk about, and I don't want to pry or ask you to talk about anything you're not willing to. But, I mean, you made it sound like you got to Okinawa and you were just a tourist. But I saw on your wall underneath your badge from your quarter century with the Stockton Police Department and another dozen years with the Sheriff's Department and with all those mementos, there's also a combat infantry badge. So I know that you saw some action with that I Company of the 17th Regiment and the 7th Infantry Division. What was that like, and what do you remember?
I don't remember a hell of a lot. It's just a lot of ducking and trying to keep alive, that's all. I don't remember a hell of a lot about it, really. You kind of block that out, to tell you the truth. I don't really have that much memory of it, to tell you the truth.
But there was still fighting going on when you got there.
Oh, yeah, sure. Certainly there was, yeah. But I survived. That's it. Yeah. I survived.
Well, and that's what I want to understand, and I want people listening to understand, because we talk about, well, the price of freedom. And the price of freedom is people like you risking your lives over there. So, I mean, I can imagine what some of the hazards might have been, but you would know for sure. You're with this rifle company, so where are you sleeping at night?
In a foxhole. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that was very comfortable and no problems.
Yeah, and it rained a lot, so a lot. It was bad memories, so I kind of blocked that stuff out.
And I'm guessing you'd never been through anything like that before, right?
Never. I was a mama's boy. Uh-huh. I don't. Mama took good care of me. Uh-huh.
And now there's no mama, and one of your brothers is flying his plane. The other one's in Europe, and you're there all alone. Did you have some buddies that you got to know that you knew you could count on?
Yeah, I had one a special friend, Russ Lamberskin. He was from Marysville, and he ended up being my platoon sergeant. But he got wounded, and he shot him in the shoulder. Just not a deep wound. He went back and he came back right away. But he was a great big guy, about 6'4". He was a hell of a soldier. Anyway, we made real good friendship. In fact, when I got out of service, I visited him in Marysville for a couple of weeks. And then he eventually moved to Stockton. Huh. And he stayed here until he worked for the government and went overseas with him again. But he was a very dear friend of mine. But he also is dead. He's passed.
Sure.
Everybody's passed. I'm the last of the Mohegans. All of my company, they're all passed away. I'm the last of the Mohegans. In fact, I'm the oldest living Stockton police officer.
So this teenager in Okinawa, sleeping in foxholes, you've got your buddy that you just told me about. Did you have to deal with enemy artillery? Was there a threat of that coming in and landing on you?
Oh, yeah, certainly. But like I say, that's almost left my memory. Yeah, that's strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
But they had artillery, but not that much toward the end, because we were winning the war. But the nights were the worst, of course, you know, because you don't see what's happening. But bad memories. I just don't dwell on them anymore.
Well, and maybe that's part of why you've had the career you've had, and you stay so active and say so young at your age. Maybe it's because you haven't dwelled on those things. But when you say the nights are the worst, is that because you can hear things happening and you can't see them, or you just imagine what might happen?
Imagine a lot. You can't see anything and you imagine a lot. You know, your memory, your imagination runs amok. It's a bad time of the night. The nights are the worst. But we all survived, you know. We left, our company went in with 220 men. Life with 127.
Were any of those guys who were killed there people that you knew or had gotten close to?
I knew some of them, yeah. Yeah, but you like to say that's so long. You know how long ago that was?
Yeah,
many moons, many moons.
Yeah, almost 75 years. Yeah, right. And again, I'm sorry if I'm being too persistent here. You put the hand up, tell me to shut up if I need to. But when somebody from your company gets wounded, gets killed, how do you handle that mentally? Does your mind go to, hey, I'm probably next, or hey, it's not going to happen to me?
It's self-preservation. It's all self-preservation. You know, you look out for your buddies, and it's, you just go on. It's just like the police department. If you have one of your buddies killed, you got to go on. I don't remember it being a big deal, really.
Well, and I guess there's that perspective. A lot of the veterans I talked to, they were in the service 75 years ago, and they didn't have a law enforcement career like you. So really, I mean, you've lived a good chunk of your life knowing that you could be in harm's way.
Yeah, but any veteran of that's seen anything at all, they don't talk about that stuff. They don't go to the movies where they shoot 'em ups. They don't. The ones I know, you don't hear them talking that stuff. They're more internal. They're more internal. They really are. Yeah.
With that in mind, I ask this respectfully: is there a moment that you look back on that you feel like that was a really close call, that could have been it for you, like so many of those other guys you knew?
No, not really. Not really. One day was just like the next. Yeah. They were all just like the next. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I forgot about that stuff. I really did. Mm-hmm. I really did. I haven't dwelled on it for, just you bring it up now. Sure. I haven't even thought about it, really.
But as far as what you guys did there, you had an objective, an area that you were supposed to take over, and how would you advance?
Very gingerly. Very gingerly. No, like I say, I don't even remember that. I don't even remember that much about it.
And as you said, you were training to invade Japan, and they told you how steep the odds were going to be. So it must have felt pretty good when you heard Japan was surrendering.
Yes, it did. It felt fantastic. We kind of cheered a little bit, and then we just said, when are we going to go home? Mm-hmm. And I didn't know there'd be another 6 months before you could go home, because all the old-timers had points. You know, you had points, and so many points that you could get to go home. And we had guys that had been there since Attu, Kiska, Kwajalein, Leyte, and Okinawa. They were all, they'd been there all that time. Mm-hmm. And in fact, my platoon sergeant, he looked like an old man. He had a beard, and when he shaved it off, he was 24 years old. Hey, 24 years old. I thought he was an old man.
Well, I have heard some stories about how quickly war can age you, and even guys, their hair turning white overnight. But you mentioned you guys were sent to Korea, and you were part of some interesting things there. You were part of the crew that actually orchestrated or carried out the changeover of control?
Yeah, we did. In fact, when we went in there, I was my platoon and a platoon from the 184th and the other regiment took the Japanese flag down, and we were assigned, we were gathered around. Somebody took the flag down, but we were the honor guard that took the flag down, the Japanese flag down. That was my claim to fame. In fact, I had a video of it, and I don't know, I don't even know if I can work the video anymore, but I had a video of it. Of me making a circle so that we took the Japanese flag down. And I don't know who, probably some admiral got it or some general got it. Mm-hmm. I didn't get it.
But you had it in your hands.
No, I didn't. I didn't even get it in my hands. Somebody else had it in their hands. I just was the honor guard. And then it was all, from then on, I was just guard duty. We went to Taejon, I think that's the town. And we set up barracks there. And then until I mustered out, we just did patrol work there and just, you know, the usual military stuff, guarded the barracks. We guarded a repo depot there that had all kind of supplies. Mm. But then I came home.
Did you have any interaction with Japanese prisoners?
Yes. We got them and took the weapons away and sent them back in carts and trucks to the coast so they could be taken back to Japan. Yeah.
Was there anything memorable about that, or did they leave you with any particular impression of who they were?
No, I talked to one Japanese lieutenant who had been, he trained in America, and he could speak English. That was an interesting part, you know, he spoke pretty good English. But other than that, nothing. They were just soldiers like me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what about the Korean civilians there? That did you get a sense of what a big deal it was for you guys, for America, the Allies, to liberate them from Japanese occupation?
Yeah, we did. Well, we had a lot of contact with the civilians, and they were pretty approachable. And, of course, you couldn't speak the language, so that was kind of difficult. But, we'd go out and meet them and talk to them. But other than that, we were kind of closed, you know, with our own company. But we didn't ever get too chummy with them. We just were there kind of a occupation. That's it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't very interesting.
This is kind of a crazy question, but I'm guessing you might have some perspective. If you can put yourself in the mind of that kid, that teenager who's there in Korea in 1945, and someone had told you, hey, America's going to be back here at war in Korea in 5 years, would you have believed him?
No, I wouldn't have believed him. No, I wouldn't have believed him. And they wanted me to re-up. Thank God I didn't re-up. They would have made me a sergeant, platoon sergeant. And I said, no thanks, because I would have been right in the thick of it again. Yeah, that would have been, I don't think I would have made it this time. So, I wouldn't have believed it. And then we lost a lot of good people there, lots of them. Yeah, police action, they called it.
Well, and a lot of them are still over there, still unaccounted for all these years later. But you were in the service during the Korean War. Tell me what you were doing.
I joined the Air Force Reserve, and by God, the Korean War started. So here I go again. I ended up at Mather Field, and then I went back to Chinook Field for some training. And I crewed a B-25, the training. There were training missions with a B-25. And then I think I only served about 15 months there. And then I got out, and then I went to the police department.
And the Stockton Police Department has been part of his life ever since. In fact, even though he is the oldest living alumnus of that department, he still finds a way to give back. It has to do with a skill he keeps oh so sharp by practicing a couple times a week. And you can see a little photographic evidence of that online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We'll hear about it from 93-year-old Les Novaresi when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.